When we last left off, we discussed Exodus 32, in which the people of Israel worshipped a golden calf, and many of them died for it. In the end of that chapter, Moses went and begged God for mercy. The chapter break, where chapter 33 begins, lands in the middle of what appears to be a continuing discussion between God and Moses. So this week, we'll be covering the narrative portions of Exodus 33 through 34, and we'll pick up the second half of God's conversation with Moses. We'll also discuss further interactions between Moses and God, briefly touching on their method of meeting before considering God's command to leave Mount Sinai, God's revelation of his glory to Moses, and the new tablets with the Ten Commandments. We will only very briefly mention the new rules which Moses recorded in Exodus 34:10 through 26. We're focusing on narrative today, not on laws. Some of what is found in that list of commands we've covered before regardless, but we'll get to whatever we skip over another day. So then, if you haven't yet read the passages, your recommended reading is Exodus 33:1 through 34:9 and 34:27 and 28. Starting at verse 7, we read about how Moses and Jehovah would meet. Previously, Moses has gone up Mount Sinai twice. He went up when God first uttered the Ten Commandments and his laws. After coming down the mountain and ratifying the covenant, Moses went up a second time to receive the Ten Commandments chiseled in stone as a record of the covenant that had been made. After his descent, he found the golden calf and shattered the Ten Commandments. At the end of chapter 32 and the beginning of chapter 33, Moses meets again with God, but evidently he doesn't ascend the mountain right away this time, meeting with God instead at the tent of meeting as described in Exodus 33:7-11. This tent of meeting, we believe, is not the tabernacle. At this point in the narrative, the tabernacle has not been built, so we are led to believe that Moses is meeting with God at an ordinary tent temporarily while the tabernacle is being constructed. And the language supports the idea that this is just a tent. Despite the fact that your King James English might call this tent the tabernacle, the Hebrew word in this passage is just ohel, meaning tent, not the mishkan we are accustomed to seeing in descriptions of the tabernacle proper. The tent of meeting was pitched outside the camp, and when the people had disputes requiring Jehovah's judgment, they would go to Moses there. When Moses would go to the tent of meeting, the people would come out to the doors of their tents in worship while the pillar of cloud, representing Jehovah's physical manifestation with Moses, would descend on the entrance of the tent. And it is important to note that the people witnessed the cloud descending on the tent. It's easy for a man to make a cloud ascend from a tent, but impossible for him to make one descend to it. 33:11 describes that Moses would speak to God face to face. We take this to be metaphorical language, meaning that they spoke clearly and directly to each other. As we will find in chapter 34, verse 20, Moses did not ever literally see God's face. Of note, verse 33:11 contains a curiosity in that Joshua would remain at the tent even when Moses was not there. Evidently, he was tasked with the tent's upkeep, and perhaps he even lived in it. How much interaction Joshua had with God and Moses at the tent is unclear. So in the end of chapter 32, we have it that Moses asked God for mercy on behalf of the people. Particularly, he asked that his name be blotted out of God's book, that is, that his debts be marked off on God's accounting ledger, so that he would no longer owe God a debt. And God agreed with this, saying that he would blot the sins of the people out of his book. This does not mean, however, that there will be no consequences for their worshiping the golden calf. The passage lists several potential consequences. First, the people are ordered to leave the Sinai area and begin their journey to the Promised Land, whether they're prepared or not. Second, God the Father will not directly accompany the people on their journey, but instead his angel will. We have discussed this angel previously in Exodus chapter 23, and there we determined that this angel is the second person of the Trinity, the Son, the pre-incarnate Jesus Christ. That message was published May 27, 2018. Now, ultimately, God will relent of both of those first two punishments before the end of today's sermons, so don't let them throw you. And third, a plague is sent on the people, but evidently it is not one so severe that it results in death. Now, I have some difficulty grasping the second of these punishments. God said that he will not accompany the Israelites in the wilderness as they go forth to take the promised land, but will send his angel. Well, we mentioned the angel before, and in that chapter I got the impression that God was sending the angel on his behalf in the first place, so I'm not entirely sure how this new arrangement would be any different from the old one. And besides, it seems to me that an omniscient God is accompanying everyone everywhere all the time. So how is it that God would not be accompanying them in this punishment? The best answer I can give you is to draw a differentiation in how much divine help the Israelites would be given in the wilderness. Before, God had offered to drive the people of the land out with hornets, and had offered the Israelites a land free of miscarriages. Well, maybe this refusal to go with them represents a refusal to perform those kinds of miraculous extras. Of note, God says that he is refusing to personally go with Israel because he might consume them on the way. Perhaps when God sends the divine hornets, they sting sinners indiscriminately. Perhaps God's refusal to go up with them then is something of a blessing in disguise. Just as they preferred not to hear from God directly when he gave the Ten Commandments, maybe now the people would also prefer not to be personally with him as they travel. However we are to understand this edict from God, we know that the people took it as a curse, and when they heard it, they mourned, and their penitence will ultimately result in God's forgiveness. God commanded that the Israelites remove their jewelry as a sign of their mourning, and they did so. That they removed their jewelry, from which they had raised the golden calf in the first place, seems to be particularly fitting. So at the tent, Moses spoke again with God, and, as we have mentioned previously, he appeals to God's nature in his requests. He asks that God himself show his paths while he leads the people in the wilderness. I think that we should take this not as a figurative request for moral or spiritual guidance. He literally is asking God to show him the right road, and I think he means that. If God doesn't lead these people, they will be completely lost in the vast wilderness between Sinai and Canaan. In making this request, Moses appeals to God's prior decisions. God has ordered Moses to lead, but now he's also said that he will not personally attend Moses. How will Moses know where to go and how to lead? How can he fulfill God's command without the help? He also appeals to God's sovereign choice. If he has favored Moses and chosen him to lead, it seems only natural that Moses should have God's guidance. Moses, then, doesn't beg for help because Moses needs it. Moses begs for help because he cannot glorify God without it. It is God's own glory that is at stake here in punishing Israel. Moses notes that Israel is nothing on its own, but Israel is only set apart from the other peoples of the world in that Jehovah is with them. So why should Jehovah punish Israel by sending them away without his guidance? He would be cutting off his nose to spite his face, so to speak. And Moses is adamant about this. If God's presence will not go with him, he asks that God not bring them out of the Sinai region. And so finally, God agrees. As we have discussed in recent weeks, the penitence of the people and the humble intercessory prayers of Moses are enough to satisfy God's demands. He tells Moses that his presence will go, noting that this is only because Moses has been granted grace. Moses and the people are in no way worthy of God's presence. And so, having obtained God's favor, in verse 18, Moses makes a bold request, that God should manifest his glory. Moses is not demanding in this regard. He asks with a Hebrew particle, na, a rough equivalent to the English please. He is here begging God that if in fact he will go with the people, that he will give Moses a personal assurance by revealing himself. And to this God also agrees. He instructs Moses to go to a certain place on the mountain, in the cleft of a rock, where he will allow Moses to see his back, but not his face. And we've mentioned the difficulties with seeing a physical manifestation of God in the past, so I won't dig into them again. Have a listen to the message The Elders See God, published June 10, 2018, for more on that topic. Moving on to chapter 34, God instructs Moses to cut new stone tablets to replace the broken ones. While the golden calf had violated God's covenant, God's mercy is evident in that he will be immediately willing to remake the covenant. Moses was instructed specifically that he should come up the mountain alone in the morning and that no one should even be nearby to see him coming up. This, of course, is because God will be showing Moses his glory. Of note, in this verse, God says that he will write on the tablets. This is a point of some contention, though, as those who look for contradictions in everything argue that there is one to be found here. They compare this verse to 34:28, which says, from the ESV, "So he was there with the Lord 40 days and 40 nights. He neither ate bread nor drank water. And he wrote on the tablets the words of the covenant, the Ten Commandments." At first glance, that sounds like Moses, not Jehovah, must have written on the tablets. But if you read carefully, you will note that the person writing on the tablets is described by a pronoun, he, and not by a proper name. It is not unreasonable, reading this verse apart from context, to conclude that this he refers to Moses. But read in the light of 34:1, in which Jehovah says that he will write on the tablets, there's no compelling reason for us to believe that he here doesn't refer to Jehovah. We must remember that the language of the Bible, and particularly the language of the Old Testament, often lacks the kind of pinpoint precision that we might want it to have. But a lack of clarity does not make a contradiction. We only have a contradiction when we find two pieces of information for which there is no possible harmonization. If a solution is available, there's no contradiction. Another point of contention surrounding those two verses centers on exactly what was written on the tablets. Believe it or not, there are some out there who claim that the Ten Commandments from Exodus 20 aren't really the Ten Commandments, and aren't what was chiseled into the stone tablets. They claim instead that God chiseled 10 new and different commandments onto the stones. Well, what commandments would those be? If we look at verses 10 through 26, there's a list of commands that God gave to Moses during this particular trip up Mount Sinai. We won't have time to get into them today. And some people, generally of the type who want to find controversy and contradiction everywhere, say that it was these words that were written on the tablets. Well, that wild theory is completely debunked by Exodus 34:1, in which God says, from the ESV, "I will write on the tablets the words that were on the first tablets which you broke." So rest assured, the Ten Commandments from Exodus 20 were the content of the stone tablets on both occasions, and both sets of tablets were directly inscribed by God. In verse 34:4, we have it that Moses faithfully obeyed his marching orders. He cut new tablets, and in the morning he went up the mountain. And in verses 5 through 9, we have the most intimate divine revelation yet. Jehovah descended on the mountain in the cloud, and he passed before Moses, evidently standing and walking, as on 2 feet. Based on their prior agreement, it is understood that Moses hid himself in the rock, such that only a glimpse of God's glory was seen, and only seen from behind. And as God passed, he proclaimed his name, which is itself imbued with power. God describes himself as merciful, slow to anger, and abounding in love and faithfulness. He reminds Moses, as this very experience demonstrates, that he is a forgiving God who, despite disciplining the guilty for a time, shows his love to the multitudes. Moses immediately bowed down in worship, and again, he begged God to forgive the people of their sins and to lead them personally through the promised land. And in verse 10, God renews his covenant. Thereafter, Moses spent 40 days on the mountain with God, the same number of days it had taken to make the covenant the first time. During his stay, God gave Moses additional commands and chiseled new tablets of stone. We note that this follows the pattern of when the covenant was made the first time. First, the elders came up the mountain and saw God. This time, Moses does that alone on their behalf. Then, God gave his commands, and he chiseled the tablets of stone over the course of 40 days. This covenant has been remade exactly as it was made before. God has thrown the sins away from the people as if they were never there. Of note, Moses did not eat or drink at all during this time. Now, not eating for 40 days, while difficult and potentially deadly, is a feat which has been accomplished by many. But not drinking for 40 days and living to tell about it, that's a true miracle. Clearly, Moses was sustained by God while he was on the mountain. And in this, of course, we learn about God's mercy. God is not malicious and vindictive. You know, people often attempt to draw a distinction between the supposedly harsh and judgmental God of the Old Testament and the never-judging, always-loving God of the New Testament. It has even been comically stated that God really mellowed out after he had a kid. But I want to point out to you that God has always been a loving and forgiving God. He didn't give us his laws because he's an authoritarian. He gave us his laws because his laws served humanity's own best interest. And he doesn't enforce his laws on the guilty because he's cruel. He enforces his laws to defend the upright among us and to further the best interest of all human society. Even in those laws which are abrogated, including all the complexities of temple worship, God was not an unreasonable authoritarian. He was providing his people with a way to interact with him, despite his being totally apart from them in his nature. And here, the people have sinned a grievous sin. They have corporately abandoned his covenant within a matter of days and turned to worshiping idols, and yet, God forgives them. A tiny fraction of them, fewer than 1%, died for the sin. And when the rest of the people displayed their penitence, God ultimately relented from punishing them. He didn't send them away. He allowed them to stay for months more while they constructed the tabernacle. He didn't withdraw from the covenant. He remade the tablets of stone. He didn't abandon the people to wander the wilderness. Rather, he showed his glory to Moses as a proof that he would remain with them. God knows how to balance justice and mercy. He will punish the guilty who must be punished, and he will do it for the best interest of us all. But he will also show us mercy 1,000 times greater. So then, in the wake of the golden calf, we had a bit of a scare there. God forced the people to reckon with the possibility that he would not go down with them, that they would have no covenant with him, and that they would wander the wilderness alone. Justice for breaking the terms of God's covenant would be harsh, but on considering the prospect, the people understood the devastating ramifications. They mourned and they repented. Moses, having been sent down from the mountain, met with God in a tent, and after securing forgiveness for the people, Moses ascended the mountain again and reinstituted the covenant with God. This time, the covenant was renewed, just as if it had never been broken. God revealed himself as at the first. He made new tablets for Moses, and he agreed to follow his people out as they crossed the wilderness. So remember that God's mercy is real. Even for the worst of sins, he offers mercy to the penitent. So when you falter, don't lose hope. Come to God in repentance. I'm sure that God has enough grace for you as well. For those of you who are listening to this message away from your computer and are looking for more like it, you can find us at eastjordan.church.